You are listening to the Horse Radio Network, part of the Equine Network family.
The countdown to the Olympic Games in Paris is on. This week, we're talking about rider biomechanics and how to have a constructive conversation about horse welfare in this prickly political day and age. Thanks for tuning in. From Heels Down Mag, a podcast where horse pros chat about what's happening in the horse world over drinks. Welcome to Happy Hour. I'm Justine Griffin.
I'm Jessica Payne.
And I'm Ellie Woznicka. Welcome to episode 122 of Heels Down Happy Hour.
Hey, girls.
Hello, hello.
What's going on?
How's it going?
Still in the swamp, but it's fine.
I feel like there's light at the end of the tunnel. I feel like you're going to be on the upslopes. It's got to be getting better.
Yeah, although yesterday we had like, it was a feels like a 15 because we had 40 mile an hour winds. Yeah, like my power was out in like my whole county.
Oh my goodness.
And I didn't have any food. Yeah, and I didn't have any food I could eat without a microwave. So I had to drive to Taco Bell, which is like 30 minutes away.
Had to get that Taco Bell.
I know.
That is some commitment. That's some commitment, man.
I'm sure there were like 20 other places that were still that 20-minute drive, and you're like, gotta get Taco Bell.
Yeah. I mean, that was the one. But yeah, so I'm hopeful. Today it was like 60 degrees and sunny. So I'm like, please dry the ground. I'm over it.
Ugh.
But how about you guys?
We're good. We're in the swing, middle of a show season craziness, and you know, all's good.
I saw you guys hosted another one of those in-house clinics. It looks like you're getting a great turnout.
They've been so fun. Okay, I will say it was cold and windy, but it was sunny, so it was nice. But it's been fun getting to know people in the area. And it's different because it's not like every week we do it. I think we're trying to do it every 6 to 8 weeks type thing, like when we're home on a weekend, which isn't as often as we'd like. But we'll do it and then open it up for people to come in and ride with Doug. And he talks a lot and he's got like the whole sound system set up and he does a little bit of riding throughout it, depending on how many people and horses are there. And it was really good turnout and it was fun. It was fun to watch a lot of lessons and see kind of breaking down the basics where it doesn't matter if you're doing, you know, pulls on the ground to meter 20. It all really is about rideability.
That's awesome. And what a great opportunity for people and, you know, like close by who could trailer into you to have access to your facility and to Doug. I mean, that's awesome.
Yeah, it's been super fun. I'm pretty sure when it was like flapping wind, the flags were flapping and everything. I'm pretty positive people were not happy that the flags were there, but it's a good way to just kind of get horses out and get them into a different environment where it is a pretty lit up environment here. And so all the horses behaved really well. And it was a really good day, actually.
That's awesome.
Yeah. I heard you have a fun drink, though, this week.
I do. Okay. So a disclaimer, though, I am not. Okay. When you go to brunch, what do you guys drink? Are you the Bloody Mary gal or mimosa girl?
I'm a mimosa girl.
I'm pretty sure
you could have guessed that.
Yes. I'm a mimosa with a, you know, the splash of orange juice, but I will every blue moon do a Bloody Mary.
Same. It has to be like a really good looking Bloody Mary for me to go I'll try that one, you know?
Like, you know, the presentation that comes out and you see it with all the different things. I saw one with like shrimp coming out of them. I'm like, okay, I should try that one instead of the mimosa.
I've seen ones with like burger sliders on them. Like it's like a lunch on your cup, you know?
Oh, I have not seen that. That's amazing. If I see a big pickle on it, that's definitely not happening. I'm not eating that one. But I do a burger slider. That's amazing. I want to
Florida, man, we go crazy. We go all out on our brunches. But I went to a friend had a little shower party at her house recently and had like an amazing Bloody Mary bar. And I was like, this is something I could never accomplish myself. So I just need the recipe because it was so good. So that's what I have to share for this week.
Did she separate it into everything that you could make your own?
Mm-hmm. Yep. It was great. Yeah. Like they had a little bartender, like, make the drink, and then you could pick all your fixins, you know?
Yeah, like an omelet station for a Bloody Mary.
Exactly.
no, like, that's why.
That sounds like such a great idea overall.
It was fun for like a little shower party, you know. It was nice. So let me tell you all about it. So the ingredients list is long because of all the fixins. But basically, what you definitely need is a bottle of tomato juice. Pick your own vodka. We were drinking Tito's this day. Worcestershire sauce, horseradish of any kind. You know, if you could do fresh grated, I think that's probably better. Celery salt, brown black pepper, a little bit of soy sauce. I feel like this is the secret sauce, is the soy sauce.
Ooh.
A couple of dashes of Tabasco, a lime cut into wedges for the, you know, for all the fixins. Some people do like New Orleans style seasoning that you put on, you know, like you kind of dash it over the drink. And then a couple of pickled jalapeno rings is, I think, really what made the difference in this Bloody Mary bar. I'm not a jalapeno person and I hate pickled things, but I don't know. It worked. I'm not. Maybe it's the alcohol. They tasted really great after a couple of these, but they were great. Then you could do all different types of olives, you know, whatever is your favorite.
Oh, see, that would be me. I'd hit up a lot of olives in mine instead.
Definitely. And then she had pickled okra, which is also not something I would normally try, but it was great. Also, green beans, like the stalks of green beans and celery stalks.
Nice.
Yeah. So basically, for the actual liquid that you consume in this, you combine a lot of it into a pitcher. So the tomato juice, the vodka, the Worcestershire, the horseradish, celery salt, pepper, soy sauce, Tabasco, mix it all up, then start decorating with all the other things. Add some seasonings if you want. We served them in like cold glasses over ice. It was great. I was very pleased with it. So if you're like me and you're not really a Bloody Mary person, this is the recipe to get you started. I think it would change your mind.
So, I love this.
Yeah, it's a good one. So bookmark this one for sure. And we'll share the recipe in the show notes.
Yeah.
But also, last episode, we talked about doing a poll about our cocktail choices. And
yes.
I was pleasantly surprised that
I loved it.
I know. It was pretty darn even. Like, you guys like all the drinks we bring to the table, which is great to hear. But Grace from the Facebook group, like, had the best comment ever. So I just felt like we had to read it on the air because I feel like it captures the essence of the show, right? So Grace said her response to the poll is a lot like Jess's perspective about braiding and fancy turnout. which girl are you that day? Depending on the situation, I could be drinking like Ellie, Jess, or Justine. Like any drink Ellie brings, I'm like, ooh, this is a perfect pool day drink. When she brought up Matt's watermelon concoction, which was the watermelon Jolly Rancher from the last episode, my first thought was, I'm making a big batch of this concentrate in an igloo canteen, and it's coming to the family beach vacation. Perfect thought. Whereas Justine's drinks are usually like unwinding on a weekday night or making a signature cocktail for a dinner party. And Jess's are like, I'm early to my dinner reservation. Let's pop over to the bar and get a drink first. Or I'm sitting by the fireplace in my pajamas and I want a nightcap.
I feel like that's the definition of my life right
there. I know. You nailed it. You nailed it, Grace.
I go to dinner or I'm going to bed at 8 o'clock and I need my nightcap.
Exactly. It's like, so it was too good not to say on the show, you know?
Oh, yeah. It's like, we should have this in, like, the description of the show.
This is us. If you'd like to meet all the guests, here we are. In the nutshell, this is us.
That was fun.
She lives nowhere near a beach, so she just dreams about being at a beach.
Ellie is at the pool on the side. Ellie's sick of the cold, so she needs the warm weather, and she brings that in her drinks. I feel like that should be Ellie's description, actually.
Oh, yeah.
Absolutely. This episode is brought to you by Zero Proof Horse Treats. Let's kick off our news. Jess, do you want to go first?
Yes, I do. Okay, so social media took a rampage this week about the whole FEI coming out with their social media guidelines and all their new rules and regulations and everything. And I feel like it kind of got misunderstood. And so when I first saw it on social media, I'm not going to lie, I was like, oh my goodness, this is every FEI competition. Like, I don't understand. And it's very similar to, honestly, like any big championship games, they already have these in place. So I thought they were taking it a step further and saying, this is at every FEI competition. And so instead, I broke down and I actually read the rules and I was like, okay, no, it's actually just at the major competitions. And so the FEI named events, meaning the World Championships, the League of Nations, any kind of World Cup, any Nations Cup, any of that that's like an FEI type competition, that's where they're stating it. And so what they're saying is they want the video rights to be theirs and the footage is theirs. So any video that is taken can be published on anybody's social media. So if I was there to watch Doug, or if I was even a, you know, whomever watching, I can't take video and publish for my own rights, that those rights belong to the FEI. I think this might be kind of a slippery slope that the FEI is going down, because I feel like once they kind of get in the door, they're going to want to expand it to other events. I'm hoping that's not the case, that they just want it for their big, you know, they're essentially the title sponsor. So they want the naming rights. I get that. But I don't know. They have broken it down that it is field of play, you know, Kiss and Cry, warm up rings. Like, it's not in the barns and stuff. So, I mean, I don't know. I'd love you guys' take. I don't know if you've seen this, because I'm kind of mixed into understanding why they're doing it, and at the same time, concerned that it's going down a slippery slope of then this is just going to be the new thing for every event.
Yeah, I hate to say the word censorship, but it is, you know, putting rules in place like this.
Concerns.
Yeah, I think a slippery slope is a very accurate way to describe it, Jess. I sort of get where they're coming from with wanting 100%. To have a little bit more control of the image that's being presented, especially in this day and age of horse welfare. But I feel like clamping down on who has access is never the right answer. You want to be as transparent and as open as possible generally, but I don't know. You know, they issued this clarification, but I wish we would hear more from FEI officials about what is the crux of this? What was the discussion leading up to this? Why do they want to do this? Like, what is, you know,
I think it's more for the power that they're the naming rights. So the, you know, if you go to the Olympics or the Pan American Games, to some degree, they already have this in the field of play. So they're just now saying, okay, we can sell these rights to media companies if we do it as well. You know, so they're seeing that door, which I get, like, it's very good when it's the World Equestrian or the Olympics or the Pan Ams and like that. But like, so now we're just going to open it up. There's no
more. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, that's where I just have the problem. If they stated that they would never do it and they said, look, it's just for these naming right ones, fine. But that's not what this states is like. It's the slippery slope is what concerns me, to be honest.
I think, and obviously when this news came out, it caused like a viral, very rabid reaction online, and Doug posted about it too, you know. And I think from an athlete perspective, you know, so how do you guys feel about, like, if Doug is competing in a Nations Cup, is he just not allowed to post anything that isn't shared by the FEI through their channels?
But yeah, and you know, to like, you know, kind of say like, okay, let's say everything's posted, great, well, what if he's not the top rider and they don't share any content? Then he can't share anything? Like, that's not fair as well. Like, what if I'm at Six Senses, or, you know, there are a bunch of people that pay these media companies to do all their stuff. So they have their own private people there to take images and video and everything else of them. So they have content available in this digital marketing, social media era of, like, you know, it's kind of a little bit nuts. But so they have all that. Well, what if he's behind the number one rider in the world and they shoot all the content of them on cross country and you go back and you try to do it? Well, they're not getting every player and they're not sharing everything. And what states in here is that you can only share what they have published. Well, what if they didn't get you? Or what if you're just not a big enough rider, but you're still there for your first major games and you want to share it because you're excited to be there. But because you're not the number one rider in the world, you can't share this on your social media.
Yeah, I'm not a fan, to be honest. I think it's a load of crap, to be completely honest. It's FEI trying to make money, more mm-hmm. money off of these things. When in reality, it's like, and good luck trying to enforce this. I wish them the best of luck because it's
they're
not
going to be able
happen.
To enforce it on the riders. They're right, going to yeah. be able to bring that on. So it is yeah. going to affect the riders. Now, okay, if Joe Schmo is there videoing and videos, I don't know, whomever, and videos the 250 billionth ranked rider in the world that's there for their first Pan Am Games and shares it all over the world. Now, that rider can't share that, but it goes viral. They're not going to get hung up in court, most likely, for that. Like, that guy has no affiliation to the FEI. He's not an FEI rider. He's not an FEI owner. He's nothing. So that's where it's going to be hard to reinforce, is getting the bystanders and the spectators and people like that not to post.
Yeah. And I have a big issue. I mean, granted, never been to an FEI event, never going to compete in an FEI event. Okay. I'm not one of those people. Right. But I think bull crap that you can't, like, if you took a video of Doug, say you were trying to sell the horse or, you know, whatever, and you wanted to post it on your social media. Now you can't because FEI didn't. I think that's just crap. Maybe you got a better angle than FEI did on this one jump and the horse looks absolutely phenomenal. And now you can't post it because FEI says no. I think it's bull. And it's taking, in my opinion, as someone who used to be a horse show photographer, it's taking the fun out of it.
Yeah.
It's taking the fun out of it. Like, as someone who shows solely for those quality photos, I don't care, like, who takes it. If it's the better photo, that's the one I want, you know?
Yeah.
And it's just like, I don't know. I just think it's, I don't know. I agree with the outlash on social media. I mean, I get it from, like, a not being in the barns and, like, a welfare perspective, but I don't understand it from, like, a competing standpoint. Like, if you take a 10-second clip of a horse over a jump and you want to post that on your social media and it's your horse and it's your husband riding the horse, they can't tell you not to do that. Like, I don't know. I mean,
Like, reading this coverage, I feel like Euro Dressage has done the best job really keeping up with it. But, like, I wondered, like, does this exist in other sports, in golf, in tennis, or is it only...
So, like, think about the Masters. The Masters, you can't have any cameras or videos or anything on the final days.
Okay. Like, and that's for every spectator?
Oh, yeah. I mean, so we went to the Masters years ago, and maybe this has changed, and I haven't looked up any of this. So I'm just stating from, like, when we were living in Aiken years ago, like, I guess you can take pictures and stuff during practice rounds. And I'll have to clarify this if anybody want to go further. But during practice rounds, so like Monday, Tuesday, maybe Wednesday, I don't really know. But definitely for Thursday through Sunday, you can't bring any phones. They have pay phones and like phones that you can use there. And so we had to leave our phones in the car. You can have nothing on you to go into the Masters.
Interesting.
Yeah. So like Doug watched Tiger win at the very end and everybody just experienced it for real life, which was pretty incredible. But at the same time, I'm not sure how, you know, what they post and all this, and I'm not a golfer, right, so I don't know like how it goes. But think about how many cameras and documents were there, and they had so much media. So like you didn't miss any part of it, and you're only going one at a time, you know what I mean? So like, or two at a time. But they're getting every moment because there's so much media there already. So I don't know what their rules are and everything, but I do know, like, as a spectator, you can't at certain events like that.
I've been to some clinics where, like, the clinician will say, like, no video. And, like, the only video they want is video that they have taken themselves. So, like, you know, for example, like the Buck Brandeman clinic, right? He's like, you know, I don't want any filming. You can take as many photos as you want, you know, but just don't, like, he doesn't want his you know, basically people getting a free clinic if you record the whole thing and post on the internet. You know, so I understand it from that perspective, but, you know, still have the photo rights and stuff. But I mean, I feel like, especially with the pride that, again, I'm speculating because I've never been to an FEI event, but like, I feel like people should take such pride in the fact that they're competing at that level, and to not be able to share that on their own personal social media, I feel like, yeah, I just feel like it takes the fun out, you know?
Yeah.
Like,
we'll see how, you know, we'll see how this ends up. I feel like it's far from being over and finalized, you know? There's a lot of
I think we're going to have a lot feedback to hear about it.
100%. Exactly. What do you got, Ellie?
I found these cool photos from Paris getting set up for the equestrian events.
They're so cool looking.
Oh my gosh, it looks so picturesque. I'm just like, this would be so nice. And there was this cool like little video where they walked you through like the dorms for the athletes to stay in and stuff. And I'm just getting really excited for the Olympics. It's such a beautiful venue. And I'm just excited to see things happen. You know, I'm just really excited.
Yeah,
and the photos are beautiful.
I can't wait till we see some hints of like what the cross country course is going to look like, and you know what I mean. I know we're a little early for that, but we'll share the link to these photos in the show notes so you guys can see. But it's, I mean, what a beautiful landscape for equestrian sport. You know, like it's going to be pretty awesome.
Well, oh, absolutely. Your backdrops Versailles, like you can't beat that.
Yeah, seriously.
What about you, Justine? I know you have some sad news.
I do have sad news, and it's in-house news about us. So if you haven't noticed already, if you are a subscriber to the Heels Down Spark, our daily newsletter, we are ending the Spark. So this is the last week it will publish. And as the person who puts it together for you every day, it's been a labor of love for years for me. Before it was the Spark, it was the Heels Down Brief. And before it was the Brief, it was the Rollback, if you guys have been Heels Down followers for all these years. And, you know, it's been a really fun journey. I've loved doing it. And I've gotten lots of comments and emails about it ending. And I appreciate all of you who woke up every morning and read the Spark. But basically, it is good news if you love this podcast, because we want to put more time and energy into the podcast this year. And so we had to make some tough decisions, and that's why the Spark is going away. But stick with us, stick with like following Heels Down on our various platforms, because we want to do more with the podcast. So you'll be hearing more from the three of us going forward, even though you won't be seeing us in your inboxes nearly like you were. So enjoy these last few editions of the Spark. We'll have a special cheers at the end of the episode for the newsletter going away. But anyways, we appreciate you guys reading it for all this time. It really has been a labor of love. I'm not kidding when I say that. So again, this episode is brought to you by Zero Proof Horse Treats. We love Zero Proof here at Heels Down. They have so many great flavors that align so beautifully with this podcast, right? All based on cocktail flavors, and they are made from distillery grains, oats, alfalfa, maybe a little touch of molasses, with natural flavors like apple, mint, orange, and cherry. And not only are they marketed after cocktails, but they're made in Kentucky. All the ingredients are grown right in the bourbon capital of Kentucky. And Zero Proof is about to release a new flavor this month, and I can't wait to find out what it is. So I know you guys will have to.
I'm so excited. And so are the ponies.
Exactly. Right? Like, keep your eyes peeled on our social media, but also Zero Proof's social media, because they're going to be announcing it soon. And if you're interested in trying these treats for yourself, I can say all the horses I've ever fed them to love them. They're a great little size that don't crumble. They don't fall apart in your pocket, but they're small enough that they're like great to keep in your pocket at the horse show or in your trunk. You can get a great discount if you order at Zero Proof's website and use the promo code HEELSDOWN for free shipping and a free gift. So guys, it feels like it's the time of year to finally start thinking about putting your blankets away. I mean, maybe not you, Ellie, since your weather
Ellie's weather is so wild late.
I know, it's nuts. But like here, we just had like our last little cool front, and then like the low was 51. I'm sorry to rub it in, Ellie, but I'm like, okay, it's time to take the blankets home. So I'm about to wash them and yada yada. But I have a few that have some holes in them, and it's usually I run them up to Ocala to get repaired for like major repairs, like if I have to get straps re-put back on or have like huge tears if I'm trying to sit, like if a blanket is salvageable. But I found this company, which funny enough, Jess, they're from Jackson, Wyoming. They're called No Sew Patches, and they're born out of like ski gear. Yeah, very cool, sustainable patches for outdoor gear. So like ski jackets, ski bibs, your Carhartt gear, anything, you know, like your tough outer wear for winter. They make really cool patches that are super easy to basically save your coats and save your pants, where they just adhere to the outside of the fabric, use a little bit of heat to seal them. Huh. And the mission of No Sew, they don't want more fabrics to end up in a landfill, right? Like instead of getting rid of your torn up gear, give it a second life by patching it up and letting it live for longer. And they do a great job. So naturally, they figured out like, oh, these patches could work for horse blankets, too. And they make a big size that is perfect for horse blankets, actually.
That's really nice. Yeah.
Yeah. So they sent me some, and I've the ones that they sent me are, I think they're 5 inches by 3 inches across. So we posted a cool reel on our Instagram to show you guys, but it will cover most like modest size holes in your blankets. And it's very easy to apply. Essentially, you want your blanket to be clean, so wash it first before you try to fix the hole. But it has like a sticky adhesive. You just pull the tab off the bottom, slap it on there, even it out, make sure it's nice and smooth. Add some heat. You can use like a blow dryer for 30 seconds. Or if you're at home, you could throw it in the dryer on like a low tumble cycle. And that will make that patch adhere to your fabric. And the patches last. So I patched a sheet that Mikey tore a hole in, I don't know, probably 6 weeks ago, and he's been wearing it for the rest of the season. He's been out in the rain. He's rolled in the mud in it, and that patch is part of the blanket now. It is not coming off. So for a patch that costs less than $20, that's a lot cheaper than me driving 2 hours to drop my blanket off.
Yeah.
For a person to repair it. So it's definitely worth trying. And they come in super fun, like cool patterns and colors. You can be as funky and as silly as you want. Or you could find something that matches your blankets if you want to keep your colors all matchy-matchy. But I really like No Sew's mission that they want to, you know, upcycle fabrics. They want to extend the life of your fabrics. And we want to keep less materials out of landfills if we can. So you could check them out by going to No Sew, which is N-O-S-O, patches, P-A-T-C-H-E-S.com. And you could find the ones that fit horse blankets for yourself.
I'm definitely getting some of these because
absolutely
I use old blankets and sew and patch my own. And this would save me.
This would be your lifesaver right there.
For real.
Yeah, I've been really impressed with how durable they are. Like, I think they would hold up, too, for like years to come. All right, everybody. I'm very excited to introduce our guest on the show this month. We have Amelia Newcomb, who is no newcomer to Healstone Happy Hour. Amelia is a USDF gold medalist. She's based in Somas, California. And she, if you don't know her YouTube channel, I don't know what you're doing, because she has over 220,000 subscribers and counting these days, and is known for her thousands of courses that she offers online through her various programs and has really great active communities on social media. And Amelia, we're so thrilled to have you back. How's it going?
It's going great. Thank you for that lovely introduction. I love horses. I love riding. So I'm eager to talk to you today about some riding.
Absolutely. I feel like every time we have you on, you just do a wonderful job of distilling the most complicated theory aspects of riding for the average rider. And, you know, I'm an amateur. I appreciate all the help I can get. And I've been someone who's taken your courses online and have learned a ton from them. So we're always thrilled to have you back on the show.
Yeah, thank you. Well, I'm happy to be here.
So to kick it off, I've got a question for you that is something I'm dealing with personally to start out with. So I am transitioning from being an eventer to a pure dressage rider this year, which is a big change for me. But something that's come up with various instructors I've had over the years is they always talk about this goal of being able to ride with an independent seat. And in theory, I totally get what they mean, I think. But when it's time to like put that into practice, it all falls apart. And I just don't understand how to differentiate my seat always. So I wonder if you have any guidance, or how do you try to explain what it means to have an independent seat to your students?
Yeah, that's a great question. And I think you're not alone in struggling with finding an independent seat. It's definitely something that all riders struggle with at first. So the first thing that's important to understand is that the main function of your seat is to follow and absorb the motion of your horse's back. So whatever your horse is doing, whether they're walking, they're trotting, or they're cantering, you really want to stay glued in. And so I always say that the leather of your breeches should stay connected to the leather of your saddle. Mm. And then what gets tricky is that when you cue your horse, so say that you need to use a leg aid or you need to use a rein aid, that your feet has to stay always following the motion of your horse. And it's tricky. It requires a combination of strength and tone in your muscles, but you also have to be flexible in your hips and in your back in order to absorb the motion of the horse. It's an amazing feeling, though, when you start to ride with an independent seat, when you're able to sit the trot and sit the canter. Then you have harmony and connection with your horse, and you can ride with really subtle and refined aid. Plus, your horse really enjoys it when you have an independent seat.
Oh, that sounds okay. That makes a lot more sense now. And it does sound like the goal, right, is to get to that point to be able to distinguish that. I have another question, a little on a different track, but not totally. Do you have any tips, Amelia, on what to do when you feel like you've lost your balance or your sync with your horse? Maybe like when you have that lovely canter where you feel totally connected with him and his back, what can you do in just like a few strides to help return to that centered position and maybe not overcorrect your horse who may be trying to compensate for maybe me being out of balance? Does that make sense?
Yeah, that's a great question. And it happens often, you know, maybe your horse stumbles, or maybe you do a transition, or they go a little faster, or they spook a little bit. And sometimes we do get out of balance. A couple of things that really help me is remembering to sit back and keep my hands down, because a lot of times when we get out of balance, we are a little tip forward. And for some reason, our hands always go up. Like that's default human reaction is lean forward and pull on the reins. Unfortunately, that doesn't really help you to get back in balance with your horse. So I think about lowering my center of gravity, sitting back, putting my hands down. And ideally, if you can keep going, that's the best. But if you're really out of balance, sometimes it is okay to go back to the walk, get your body reorganized, and then go up to the trot or the canter again.
Oh man, you like nailed all of my bad habits. One answer.
I'm like, oh man, I'm taking that personally because I probably should.
But no, it's a good reminder. Thank you.
I have a question for you. I'm coming out of a long rehab myself. I was paralyzed back in 2022. And this is something I haven't struggled with before. So I'm wondering, is there something I'm doing wrong if I'm having like lower back pain at the end of like a ride or a lesson?
Yeah, that's a good question. And a couple of things that are important to consider. The first one is that when you're riding, you want to have the correct alignment. So it should be ear, shoulder, hip, heel. And what this does is it puts you in a neutral spine position. Another thing that you can do is just while you're sitting here, everyone, while you're listening to this podcast, is just put your hands underneath your seat bone, palm up. So you're basically sitting on your hands. And what you want to feel is you want to feel that your seat bones are pointing straight down. Now, the next thing that you can do is overarch your back and kind of stick your belly out, and you'll feel your seat bones pointing backwards now. And then on the up opposite spectrum of that is you're going to hunch your back and really tilt your pelvis forward. And again, you'll feel your seat bones disappear. So when you're riding, go back to that neutral pelvis position and you want to feel that your seat bones are pointing down into the saddle. And then it's important that you support your lower back by keeping a little bit of tone in your core. So a lot of times, if you overarch your back or if you're not in the correct alignment or if your core is not tight enough, it can cause you to have back pain because you're not supporting your spine to be in a healthy position. Your saddle fit could also, you know, impact that as well. But I definitely think finding your neutral position and then, of course, doing things out of the saddle, different types of core strengthening exercises. I really like Pilates, but it is very important to stretch and work on your fitness outside of the saddle.
Absolutely. That was great. And as soon as I did that, I felt some pain when I arched my back. So I was like, oh, that's telling. Whoopsie.
So you might be doing that when you're riding. You might be overarching your back and really focus on your core during transition, because that's when I see people get out of their neutral spine alignment, and then that's going to hurt your back.
Great. Thank you so much for that. So another question for you. Is there a way to minimize the jostling impact when sitting in the saddle? Like, we'll just use sitting the trot for an example. On your back and joints, if you have a previous injury, like how can I, you know, build up strength to support my back when I'm in the saddle? Because I don't want to be jostling around on my poor horse. He doesn't deserve that. So,
yeah, totally. And we all want to be the best riders we can be for our horses. So what I recommend in particular for the sitting trot is a couple of things. The first thing is that it's really important that your horse is in front of the leg before you try to sit the trot. So in front of the leg basically means that your horse stays going at the same speed without constant nagging. So you shouldn't have to be kicking your horse every stride. The reason that that's important is if you're having to apply a lot of leg aid, it makes it really hard for you to loosen in your hips and your back. And you're going to bounce in the saddle. So number one, get your horse forward. Number two is get your horse round. When your horse is round and they lift up their back muscles create a bridge. And believe it or not, the trot gets a little less bouncy and less jostling. So what I would recommend doing is really warm your horse up well. Make sure that they're forward. Make sure that they're round. I also like to do a little canter work. Try that out before you try your sitting trot. And then that will make it so that it's more comfortable for you and for your horse when it comes time for you to sit the trot.
That is great advice. And I'm sure my horse will thank you.
I do love that advice. So I have a question. So a lot of times I do so many different disciplines between the hunters and the jumpers and the eventing and dressage and everything else. Everyone always complains about my hands. How much hand should I have? So specifically speaking for the dressage, like if I'm trying to go for the event horses, should my hands move with the horse's movement? Should it be solid? Like how quiet should they be? Like talk about like everybody always says, be quiet in the hands, but then I give too much type thing. So should my hands be having some sort of conversation and how much? Like I don't want to be pulling too much, but I don't want to be giving.
Yeah, that is like the golden question that everyone asks. Yes, contact and connection for sure is the hardest part of riding for a couple of reasons. The first one is that as humans, we do everything with our hands. When we're on our phone, when we're eating, when we're on the computer, when we're driving, it's all hand, hand, hand. And when you ride, you want to make most of your aid from your seat and your legs. So part of it is kind of reprogramming your brain to go feet, leg, and then lastly, hand. That should always be the sequence of your aids. Yeah, so that will help. And then as far as establishing a steady contact, that's a little bit tricky because what happens at the walk and at the canter especially is that as your horse moves, their neck oscillates. So their neck moves a little bit. And also, since you're sitting above them, your upper body goes just very slightly more forward and backwards as the horse's back is moving. For example, in the canter, you know, the canter kind of moves like a wave. Your shoulders stay still and your hips are following that pendulum. So in order to establish a steady contact, you have to have a following elbow, which means that your elbow is very slightly bending a little more and bending a little less while you have that straight line from elbow to your horse's mouth. So that's how you establish a steady contact. And then ideally, what you're doing with your hands is you're just kind of moving your fingers a little bit to cue your horse. Like, that's the ideal world. If I'm riding my Grand Prix horse, my hands are together, they're hip width apart. I'm thinking about having forward feeling hands. And then I'm just cueing my horse by moving my fingers and maybe my wrist a little bit. So that is giving invisible rein aid that someone can't really see. I always love watching the top riders showing the Grand Prix. And a lot of times you watch their hands and you're just like, wow, like they're not doing anything with
their
hands.
They're barely playing piano, basically.
Yeah. Yes, exactly. So that is the end goal. Sometimes, you know, with a younger horse, you may have to make a bigger correction. But whenever I use my rein, I always start with my ring finger. So number one is your ring finger. Number two is your wrist. So you bend your wrist in toward, or you bend your wrist, your pinky finger comes in toward your wrist and then goes a little upward. So you basically make a little circle with your fist. And then if number two doesn't work, then you use your elbow. But you don't want to right away just start pulling back with your elbow, because you haven't given a more subtle rein aid first.
No, that makes so much sense. I love a lot of those analogies. So thank you so much.
Yeah, you're welcome.
Got one more for you, Amelia. And like, this is something that we all understand, that proper saddle fit is super important. But we want to kind of talk about, like, does our equipment truly impact the way a horse moves? Like, for example, the ergonomic designs and bridles and girth, like, are they worth the money?
Yes, that is a golden question. Again, you're asking me such hard questions.
Sorry about that.
So the truth is that buying new equipment is not going to magically make your horse go Grand Prix tomorrow. I wish I could say that if you bought like this magic saddle or this magic bridle, that instantly your horse would be perfectly trained. So it's not as simple as that. But that said, saddle fit and bridle fit, it is important because they are what enable us to communicate with our horse. So if you think about your saddle, that's the connection between your seat and your horse's back. So it is important that your saddle is comfortable for you and comfortable for your horse. It's extremely important with a saddle that it doesn't go off to one side or the other and sit crooked on your horse, because then that's going to be uncomfortable for your horse's back. It's also going to be uncomfortable for your back. And then as far as the ergonomic girth, again, that really just depends on your horse and your horse's preferences. So play around with it. You know, again, unless you're having a big saddle fit issue, I don't think that you have to go out and buy an ergonomic girth. It can help if you have a saddle that tends to go to one side or the other. And I do use the Total Saddle Fit girths are the ones that I use. And they do have a nice elastic part that allows your horse to breathe a little bit easier, which is super nice. And then as far as bridles, again, it really depends on your horse. So every horse's head is shaped a little bit differently. And look at your horse, make sure that your bridle fits properly. Make sure that it's adjusted well. The biggest mistake I see, honestly, with bridle fit is people have the bit hanging too low in the horse's mouth. So you want to make sure that the bit is up against the corner of your horse's lips. Otherwise, it could accidentally be like hitting their front teeth, which is not good. And then make sure that your nose band is adjusted correctly. And I have all videos about bridal fit and saddle fit on my YouTube channel, so it would be a little easier to see that on a video. But yeah, it's most important that your equipment is comfortable and fitting well. But no, you don't need to rush to the store and buy the new best thing every day.
No, Amelia, you have so much knowledge for free available on YouTube and on your website, which is AmeliaNewcombDressage.com. And actually, I know you just had a new free mini course that came out, which are 5 patterns to train your horse, which are really great riding accuracy patterns that anybody can do, which we'll share the link to that in our show notes and with our listeners in our Facebook group. But Amelia, if listeners want to find out more, can you tell us a little bit beyond your website and your YouTube channel? Is there anywhere else our listeners should look for you?
Yeah, we're pretty much on all the platforms. I do have a podcast, Dressage with Amelia. So check that out. I'm on Instagram at Amelia Newcomb Dressage. And the best place is to go over to the website. Like you mentioned, I have a bunch of free PDF downloads, and the one on patterns and figures is great. You will learn 5 easy exercises that you can do with your horse. There's also some drone footage, which is really fun, so that you can see the pattern from the drone view above. And I'm just passionate about helping riders of all levels and all disciplines that want to ride better. We have an incredible learning community on Facebook at Amelia's Dressage Club, which is just a great way if you have questions or if you want to get to know some people in your area that ride. That's a great place to head over to. So yeah, thank you guys for your time today.
Thank you, Amelia. You were great.
If you guys haven't, you should totally check out LiveEq. It's a free app for equestrians, and it's breaking down barriers between making the sport more accessible to everyone. The app connects riders with local opportunities, with riding lessons, leasing, jobs, and there's just so much that it can help with. If you want to check it out, go to www.liveeq, that's LiveEq.com.
All right, guys. So I got to sit down with 2 authors, Shelley Onderdonk and Adam Snow. Dr. Shelley Onderdonk is a veterinarian who was born in California. She's a graduate of Yale and also a graduate of the University of Georgia. And she's continued her medical education through the International Veterinary Acupuncture Society and the Qi Institute. Adam, who is her partner, is a professional polo player. He's been playing polo for 34 years. Achieving the highest rating of 10 goals in 2003. He has many open titles, and he's competed in the Argentine Open in 1998 and 2004. And for the last several years, Shelley and Adam have lived together and built this beautiful farm together in Aiken, South Carolina. They met when they were in college, and they've been married since the 80s. And now they raise horses on 24 acres out in Aiken. And they write books together. So their newest book is called Winning with Horses, and they co-authored it together. It's their second co-authored book. The first is Polo Life, Horses, Sport, 10, and Zen, which was published in 2016. But Winning with Horses is published by Trafalgar Square Books. You can find that at trafalgarbooks.com. And we decided to have Shelley and Adam on the show to talk about a lot of the conversations we're seeing about horse welfare in the sport right now, from veteran riders being called out on social media for the way that they're handling and training horses, to just the general perception of horse sports in the public and going forward through the Olympic Games. Shelley and Adam had really interesting and thoughtful things to say about how we communicate to each other as people who are passionate about horses. And then also how we communicate to the public and people who look at horse sports and maybe don't understand it. And I hope you guys enjoy this conversation we had with them. All right, everybody. I'm really excited to introduce our guests this week. We have Dr. Shelley Onderdonk and her husband, Adam Snow, who are 2 equestrians who wrote not 1, but 2 books together. And their latest book, Winning with Horses, was published by Trafalgar Square Books, one of our favorite publishers, and we're very excited to talk more about why they wrote their book. Welcome to the show, guys.
Thank you for having us.
So I figured it would be great to start at the book. It was a wonderful read. Honestly, you guys are horse people couple goals. It's really amazing how you've married your lives and your passions together. And what struck me most about your book, honestly, was just, I feel like it couldn't be more timely for where we are in the horse world right now, as we're talking about horse welfare issues and social license issues. And so I wanted to ask, what made you both want to share your personal experiences in your relationship with one another and horses in this way?
Well, the time was very much a factor of just serendipity, honestly. There was a point of interest from our first book, which was published in 2016, which was really strong, which talked about, or people really resonated with this idea that we as a couple were able to strike this balance between having horses who are competing at the highest level of a sport while simultaneously being very proactive about their welfare and their well-being, both physically and emotionally. And so we had that germ of an idea from our first book 8 years ago and took it as the kernel to start writing again. And eventually, when we proposed the idea to Trafalgar Square to come for them to publish our second book, they thought it was a good idea and they have supported us and published it for us.
So it was sort of an opportunity to delve more into what we call it, the secret sauce, our secret sauce of what has led to our horses and other horses that Shelley's worked with and owners to their success while still being very welfare oriented. And eventually we came around to finding the win-wins, which were both about competing and the welfare of the horse.
Sure. And I think that's exactly the theme I want to touch on here is, it's something we all have to balance as folks who love horses, right? And especially if you enjoy competing. And I think that's what makes your book resonate with so many of us is it doesn't matter what discipline you're riding, whether it's polo or show jumping or dressage. It's easy to put so much work into the sports side of things. And sometimes the emotional and physical health of the horse can get a little lost in that. I wonder, maybe Adam, if you want to answer this one first, if you can describe that aha moment with this of that finding that balance in what you did to put yourself on a different path to be more aware of horse welfare.
Sure. So one moment that I remember was when fairly late in my career, we were doing well in the US Open and my best horse, who was older, came down lame, and the veterinarian, this wasn't Shelley, this was a vet with the team, said, well, we're going to inject her with hyaluronic acid and a little bit of cortisone. Yeah. And to make a long story short, the joint went septic and she ended up like almost dying. And I remember feeling devastated that I had okayed this procedure. And what went wrong was we brought her right back into work rather than waiting 3 days in the stall. And I remember looking at Hale Bob in the clinic when her life was in limbo and just thinking that this isn't worth it. That wasn't worth it to try to play her in the quarterfinals without getting the proper rest and care that we normally did with a joint injection, which was a very rare occurrence anyway with our horses over the course of their career. So that was one aha moment that made me think, you know, I don't even care if I never get to play her again. I just want her to be healthy and happy. And I'm sorry for having inflicted this pain on her. And fortunately, she was able to lead a long, happy retirement on our farm. But that was certainly an aha moment to me and something that made me appreciate the times which Shelley had prioritize the long-term health and welfare of the horse in that it was also going to help my career because having the horses more years healthy is a huge advantage as well.
Yeah, Shelley, you're welcome to answer the question too. I mean, you come at it from a different background being a vet. Curious of your thoughts.
Yeah, so it definitely probably was not an aha moment for me in the sense it was just sort of who I was from a child. I was a horse lover from the very moment that I can remember, earliest moments I can remember. And so, and I loved to do anything with horses. Didn't matter whether I just was watching them or brushing them or riding them. And so that idea of taking care of them was always sort of part and parcel of my riding. And I really haven't competed much in my life. It's definitely like way probably tertiary for me, although I do love competing. And so I also like to think about root problems rather than symptoms. And that's something that is part of the reason I do what I do as a veterinarian, as far as doing integrative medicine. And so I also think about that with the horse welfare. It's like, well, it's not just about, you know, what we do with them today. It's a much bigger question. It's like birth to death, you know, like the whole life of the horse and the whole way that the horses live, not just, you know, that we don't abuse them. And so I've just spent a lot of time thinking and learning. I'm still learning so much about horses and how they can thrive. And that's just something I've always been interested in.
Yeah, it's fascinating. I'm an amateur rider and I've talked a lot about my own horses on the podcast. And the my horse I've had for many years, who's been a hunter, an eventer, and most recently a dressage horse. I spent 2 years rehabbing a soft tissue injury, which is an excruciatingly long process, but I'm very grateful for him to be sound. But I will tell you, without that experience, I mean, it's really changed the way I personally view the relationship I have with my horse and what my responsibility is, right? I had a very similar aha moment where it was just like, I felt this intense guilt, right? Did I cause this? Did I put my horse in a situation that changed his life forever? And after a very long spell of stall rest, I just couldn't wait to let him be a horse for the first time in a very long time, you know? But it could be a very lonely place when you're trying to figure those things out, right? Because the way the sport is set up, I feel like it's hard to have these conversations. And so that's kind of leads me into my next question here. Like, what is the best way to have these kinds of horse welfare conversations with other people in the sport? I feel like, especially now in this crucial time when we're talking about how horse sports are viewed by the public, obviously there's been some health headlines out there about welfare with a few, you know, well-known trainers lately from Wellington to Europe. And, you know, it's an Olympic year where the horses are going to be in, you know, the mainstream media. I mean, do you guys have any tips on just how do you start having these conversations that can be hard sometimes?
Yeah, it's very difficult and can be very fraught. So I guess my initial reaction is like you have these conversations very delicately. But the real thing that needs to happen is that you, as a person, from my perspective, for example, a veterinarian or, you know, an author, somebody who's written a book, I don't want to be didactic. I don't want to be preachy. I ask questions. So if I see that there's some kind of an issue, I'm not going to confront the person and say, oh, well, there's this issue with your horse. I'm going to say, hey, what's your plan to deal with this, for example? Or, you know, do you have any way that you're thinking about this issue? And always sort of trying to prompt people just to think about what the implications are of what their decisions are with their horses. And so that is really my best advice. I think having podcasts and books and videos and blogs out there for people to access is great. And education is obviously really important. And there's a lot of really great people who are dedicating their lives to doing those kind of educational things. And we hope our book is a little bit of a part of that. But when it comes down to it, people have to seek that out. And so you have to somehow instigate that conversation of like making people curious about what it is that you want them to try to be exposed to.
Sure. I get it. And I agree that most people, you have to be passionate enough or curious enough to want to learn more, right?
My theory is like, you know, doing good for your horse is actually going to be good for you competitively. Like a lot of people don't see it that way. A lot of people see it as an either or. And so I'm trying, you know, that's where my perspective sort of comes in. And that's where some of my clients have said, oh, you're the first veterinarian I've ever known that can kind of bridge that a little bit. Because usually mm-hmm. some people will have veterinarians that are like really holistically minded, but they're like, oh, the horse really shouldn't be worked for a month, you know, like, let's just take our time. And then other veterinarians were like, oh, I'll just go and inject the joint. You can be back to at it 2 days, you know?
Right, right.
So I'm kind of like more of a bridge person. And so I, you know, I really want to express to people, like, it's not an either or. It's just like getting yourself informed and making good decisions, you know?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's really interesting that you say that, because I think especially in a situation like that, people want an answer from a medical professional that might not always be the right answer, right? And they're looking mm-hmm. for that quickest return to play. Something I wanted to bring up too is we see things on social media now, and I do think that there is a culture, and maybe it's generational, I'm not sure, but you see people are not afraid to call others out, and it can be very abrasive in some of these videos that you see that maybe are cut or manipulated in some ways to get a point across, but also are showcasing things that don't look great for the sport. And I think we're still trying to figure out what are the roles of the USCF or the FEI on some of these things, or what should people do if they see a video of a trainer and they're outraged by it, or they don't feel good about what is circulating on social media that anybody can see. Like, how do you know to find where's a good place to start to look for credible information on how to avoid those types of problems, or avoid, you know, does that make sense? I'm sorry if I'm rambling.
Yes, it makes sense. I just want to touch on your previous question about the progress and where we learn from. And I thought of this quote that the arc of the moral universe is long, but it bends towards justice. And I feel like we are progressing in the horse world, and that it's a slow, gradual progression. It kind of made me think of, like, where do we learn our horse care practices? And it's through observation and watching good competitors in our sport, through some coaches and teachers. And then if we can learn from current science, which thankfully, you know, Shelley's a veterinarian and she goes to conferences and she's like, hey, we need to think about the heat under the bandage when you're competing. And, you know, it's sort of like, I feel like what resonates a lot with competitors are when they come to realize and believe that doing well by the horse is doing well for their competitive advantages, that it's a competitive advantage to be treating your horse the very, very best you can. And that's what I kind of came around to believing with the care of our own horses and my competing them. I'm sorry, it's not answering your most recent question. But
so I can jump in on that next question. And as far as I think it's very important for the governing bodies to have clear and fairly enforced rules about horse welfare. It can get tricky. There's no question about it. I know that there's many organizations that have been really working on this for the last 10 years or so. Like, for example, the USPA didn't have a very strong horse welfare committee up until recently. But like Adam said, I think that there has been a lot of progression, and it is a good thing. I think that for me, like as a veterinarian, it's really nice to know that the governing bodies of the sport sort of have my back a little bit, you know, so I'm not just out there on my own. And I also think that it's important for people coming up in the sport, like Adam was saying, for to have some role models. And that's going to be modeled by ultimately the governing body and what they say is appropriate, what is not appropriate.
Both of those answers make a lot of sense. Adam, to what you were saying, I do think that there is this message of holding professional athletes accountable, right? Because they are our role models. They are the people we look to for advice and guidance on what is the right way of how to treat horses and how to be competitive still. So I do think that's a really important distinction to make. You know, I think these conversations are happening on all different levels, like even amateurs like me who board my horse because I'm just not in a position to have a farm.
And in that kind of environment, I'm having to have conversations about my horse's care with the person who owns the farm or how I manage his lifestyle, right? With your experience from the two of you, do you have any tips on how you think you should have conversations about this if you want to talk to more people about it or you want to have constructive conversations in your own barn about it?
So one of the ways that I like to have this conversation, like I said before, is just be asking questions and ask people, you know, why they're doing what they're doing and try to get them to be reflective about their choices. But I also feel like if I am in their barn, then there must be something that they're interested in, which I represent, which is a little bit more of an alternative or integrative view on horses. And so I really try to explain what I'm doing and how I'm working with their horse. And so if I'm, you know, doing manual therapy sort of or some kind of other body work on the horses, to have them sort of understand the horse as a being which has these, you know, emotions and has physical tightness and has a lot of similarities maybe to them, they're going to start being like, oh wow, like that's kind of like how I am. It's amazing how many people don't, you know, don't really equate what is going on with a horse and to a human, and they're a mammal. They have many of the same hangups, both emotionally and physically, that we do. And so there's a little bit of try to use it as a teaching moment when I'm with a client and their horse. So that's sort of my perspective on it. But I'm also really careful not to really tell anything unless I'm being asked. But like I said, I will ask questions of them.
The sphere of natural horsemanship has contributed a lot to our learning, at least in this country. Just people are more and more aware that, you know, of finding a way to work with the horse and, you know, making the wrong things difficult and the right things easy. You know, I think that general philosophy of natural horsemanship, that the horse can kind of hold up a mirror when we walk into their stall and our emotions are reflected on that mirror. And so we start to be very cognizant of how we are present when we're relating to the horses on the ground or on their backs. And I feel like these are improvements in the sphere of progress.
Yeah, it's a language that more and more people speak. Huge change in the 25 years once that I've been a veterinarian.
Now, maybe at some point we'll be racing 3-year-olds instead of 2-year-olds and things like that. But, you know, time will tell.
Sure. No, and that's a good point. I think in these current conversations, it's easy to forget how far we've come, right? We've learned a lot over the course of many years, even if there's still more to learn. So another question I have that kind of gets at these tricky conversations we're talking about is, when you see some of these conversations go the wrong way, whether, you know, I feel like social media, it kind of captures a lot of that chaos sometimes, but I feel like it could be very hard for someone who is young and, you know, very passionate about what they know about horses and someone who's older and built a career or has spent a lifetime around horses. And people, I mean, you could say this for a million different things beyond horses, right? Just people kind of dig their heels in on what they know and what their worldview is. And it could be very hard for people to find common ground and talk about what's important, you know. But Adam, I think you bring up a really great point in that, like, what we did in the 1980s for horse care is very different than probably what we're doing now because we've learned a lot. And the science has guided us, culture has guided us. But how do we approach, you know, those instances where someone likes to dig their heels in and go, well, in my day, this we did it this way and this is why, when maybe like we don't use those types of bits anymore and there's good reason for that, or we don't feed horses in this way anymore because the research suggests that there's a better way to do it. But
I've had this situation a little bit in my barn presently where there's some boarders of somebody I'm coaching, And when I see practices that I wouldn't be doing, what I do is explain to them why I do it a certain way and give them a different perspective on it. So I'm not saying, you know, you shouldn't do that, you should do this, but this is what I've found success with. And I guess success in their eyes is like, oh my God, you know, Adam and Shelley had like 50 best playing ponies over the course of his career. They must have been doing something right. And we feel like we were doing something right. And that's what we're kind of talking about in Winning with Horses. But so it's like to show them, talk to them, and then let them make their decision as what I'm doing in my own bar.
And from my perspective, I think the generational divide is very potent in the horse world. I'm sure it is in lots of different environments, but in the horse world, it's very strong. And what I just try to remember is that everyone should have a beginner's mind. And the truly successful older horsemen and women and coaches and riders do have a beginner's mind. They are always looking to improve. They're always looking to evolve and taking in, like you said, the new information from both culture and from science and incorporating into their practices. And that's really wonderful to see. And that's, you know, somewhat of a personality thing that you can't really change that much. So sometimes it's not easy to change people. But if we can establish some norms, like you said, through governing bodies, through more enlightened mentorships, and through a very large number of competitors who really are embracing the more, you know, progressive ways of doing this, I think that all the sports can really benefit from that.
Absolutely. Well, my last question is more about the two of you personally. I mean, you've shared this life together. Obviously, you've learned quite a bit about horses, about competition, and you've been successful and now have this knowledge base that you've shared with readers in these books. Is there any message or maybe a favorite part of the book that you'd love to share with our listeners?
There's a lot to it.
I know. It's a hard question.
Like Kelly just said about always learning and trying to have a beginner's mind. And I think that, you know, we've done a lot with horses, but I think what keeps us excited every morning to go up to our barn and deal with our horses is that we're always learning and always developing and always training. You know, like it takes a long time to train a horse. That training's like never really done. Every time you're working with them in the stall or feeding them or riding them, you're trying to improve that relationship a little bit more. And so we certainly don't feel like we know it all. We're just scratching the surface, but it's just a joy to learn and get to work with these animals. And one of the things we write about in our book is a German word called Umwelt, and it means it's the idea that every animal has their own sensory bubble, and humans have the unique ability to imagine what another species' sensory bubble could feel like and look like. And so I guess one thing that Shelley and I try to do, in a sense, is to put ourselves in our horse's umwelt, which is not easy, but it's rewarding.
I think that's a great message. Okay, last question. Where can our listeners find your book?
They can find our book at Trafalgar Square Books. And then the title, again, is Winning with Horses. It's also on Amazon, and our website is horsesinsport.com.
Great. Excellent. All right.
So it's Rose and Thorn. Do you guys want me to go first?
Yeah, go for it.
So I'm so excited about my Rose, because I don't know why I should be shocked about this, but I'm just super excited. Doug and I have had our 10-year anniversary. And I'm more excited we remembered this year.
Oh my gosh, that's a big one. What do you mean that you remembered?
Well, because last year I forgot because I had a broken leg. And my mother told me last year. And it was so embarrassing that normally we plan, like, we've been so good. We love our anniversaries. We're like the cutest people about anniversaries. And my mom called. She's like, oh, and it was my first time driving with my broken leg. And I was driving down the horse show and I was like, okay, I'm going to go down early. And so, I mean, I still have the broken leg, but I'm driving and we're going to Bonefish with Sam and Sheridan last year. And I didn't even, honestly, I didn't even know it was March, to be honest. And so my mom, I get about 30 minutes from the hotel or from the restaurant and my mom goes, so happy anniversary. What are you guys doing tonight? I go, what are you talking about? And she goes, well, isn't today your anniversary? I said, well, what month is it? She goes, well, it's March 15th. Yep. Today's definitely our anniversary.
Oh my gosh.
Had been such a stressful couple months with the broken leg and like figuring out life and stuff that thankfully, both Doug and I forgot. So nobody could be at blame. So I called him and I was like, hey, happy anniversary, honey. And he feels mortified. I go, don't worry. I forgot too. Joan just told me, my mother. And so this year we wanted to make sure it's a big one. We didn't want to forget. So we went last week and did like a staycation, a resort nearby that was like for the night. And then we've planned dinner after Carolina this weekend so that we've made sure we've made up for forgetting our 9 year, basically.
Oh, that's nice.
So that's my rose, is that I was super proud that we planned it and we didn't forget. But my thorn is, neither of mine have nothing to do with horses this month, honestly. My thorn has got a little bit to do with horses, but the kids have 10 days off of spring break. And I've known this for like, you know, 8 months, whatever, when they started school. And I tried everywhere to find a horse show that was between their spring break or during their spring break so I could utilize the days off. Nothing on the East Coast except for WEF week 12, the big Rolex Grand Prix that obviously we do not have a horse that can jump in. It's the only horse show. So my kids, I still don't know what we're going to do with them for spring break. And it's in like 2 weeks and they're like, oh, we're going to do all these fun things. And I'm like, oh, okay, really? So my thorn is that I've got to figure out either activities at home or something to do, because I think my children think they're doing something fun for spring break because all their friends are talking about going to the beach and all these fun things. And I'm like, well, we do that enough. They're like, yeah, but spring break, you do it a lot more. I'm like, oh no. So yeah, that's my thorn, is I have to tell my kids in about 2 weeks, I have no idea what we're doing for spring break.
There's got to be a ton of stuff you can do. Science centers, museums, you know what I mean?
Yeah, I'll figure it out. But they think we've planned this elaborate vacation.
Because they're used to being on the road with you guys so much, right?
Yes. So my double thorn is they're used to being on the road that we do things. And now, there's tons of stuff in that area to do. But to explain to my children that we didn't plan their spring break, like they don't understand. I'm like, oh no, it's fine. This is normal. They're like, oh no, Helena's going to the beach and DJ's going everywhere. And I'm like, oh, well, yeah. Okay, we'll figure that out in a couple weeks. Mike did too.
You've got time. I'm not worried about you. You'll figure it out.
Oh, no. But that's my thorn, is that I couldn't find a horse show to blame it on the horse show for the week.
That's funny.
What do you have, Justine?
All right. So I'll start with my thorn because it's a long story.
Oh no.
It's okay.
Okay.
Mikey?
No, it's not Mikey. Okay. It's not Mikey. Thank God it's not Mikey.
We're good.
So my parents are in Australia right now. And they're like living their wonderful retired life, like going on month-long trips. I'm very happy for them. My dad's worked very hard. He deserves it. And so, you know, being the good child that I am, they live in town. We check on the house. They also happen to live on the beach. So Alex and I were like, let's go spend the night at their house this last weekend. and enjoy the beach because the weather's been very nice. Well, it's also like, it's like hell time if you're somebody who is a Florida resident full time, because like it's packed everywhere.
Spring breaks,
snowbirds. Like to get anywhere near the beach is like just an absolute nightmare. And this is like very like first world problems. I'm just gonna straight up say it. I don't live on the beach. My parents do. Okay, but I'm just trying to take advantage of free opportunity I have to go to the beach. And my parents live in like, you know, what they own is like within this community, and they don't want dogs there. We sneak by dogs in. they have a shared parking garage with, you know, like other buildings all around them. And it's full of like seasonal residents this time of year. But, you know, my parents have lived there for like 20 years, you know? So it's like, for me, it's like home going there. So
yeah,
we pull up Friday night, we pick up takeout on the way onto the beach, and then we have to like very strategically sneak the dogs in, and we do that just fine. But I park in the parking garage in a spot closest to the door, so Alex and I can like shepherd in all the groceries and the dogs really quick, get them in, and then I run back to the parking garage. And let me tell you, it's been like 10 minutes. Really, it's not been a long time. And I go back to move my truck, which is parked in the spot that's not my parents, but I'm just, again, trying to like get all my stuff in quickly, get in, get out, and then move the car. And so I come back, and there I could see the man walking away, and there is another vehicle parked behind my truck very, very aggressively and purposely, not in a spot, but to like make it so I cannot back out of the parking spot. Like he's blocked me in. This man, very obviously, like I must be parked in his parking spot, because he is in 2 minutes has been, you know, ready to stage and road rage altercation, and parked behind me in a way that he's literally just like in the middle of the lane of traffic for other people to go around. But he's wedged himself in a way that he thinks that I can't get out of, right? Like that he's blocked me in. And so I'm looking around trying to see, because I can only see the parked vehicle that I can't get around. I'm looking around to see where this person is. Like, is somebody here? Can I apologize? And just like, will he let me move my truck? I don't see him right away. So then I'm assessing of like, what do I do? Because clearly, like, my truck shouldn't stay here. His vehicle can't stay this way. I call Alex, who is with the dogs in the house. And I just said, like, don't come down, because we don't need
a situation.
Yeah. But like, if I call you again, it's because somebody has a gun. This is Florida, you know? So,
I gotta be ready to show up.
Okay. Yeah. Be ready to show up, but don't come now. Like, I'm not going to make it dramatic. So I start assessing the situation, because there's a car parked next to me. And the way that this gentleman parked was like, so I couldn't get out, but he's not affecting the other car. And I start thinking, I can do this. I can back this truck out. And so I get in my car and I start backing my truck out. And you know, the only reason I can do this, man, is the horse trailer. The horse trailer taught me how to do this. Okay.
Yeah.
And it took me probably 15 to 25 micro go forward, back up, go forward, back up, turn my wheel to do it. But I backed that damn truck out of this road rage altercation.
Absolutely.
Problem. And as I'm backing up, you know, I mean, I'm like, I've got millimeters on both sides of the vehicles. Yeah. I'm backing out. And then I see the guy, and he's standing on the other corner of the parking garage filming me, because I think he's like dead set in his brain that I'm going to hit his car and he's going to capture this all. And so, but I did not hit that.
No, because you're
string of expletives.
Absolutely.
Car. I backed that truck up. I got out of his trap. And then I rolled down my window as I was leaving the parking garage to apologize to him, nice as pie. And he goes, well, I parked like that just so I could keep you there till the tow truck arrived. And I was like, well, better luck next time, buddy, as I drove away.
Yeah. What an a-hole.
I know. This is the other side of Florida you guys don't see. Oh, but
God. I actually saw the funniest, like, meme that I might have to put in later, because I'm going to be like butchering it, but it's like, when you think like the richest place in is like Florida, or the trashiest place, Florida, it's all in one.
Oh yeah.
It's probably all of the United States.
No, Florida is its own animal. No one's here for long enough to know that. But I mean, on the guy's defense, I parked in a spot. I understand that. But it was like literally less than 10 minutes. You know what I mean? Like, if you really want your parking spot, why wouldn't you let me vacate it as soon as possible?
Yeah.
Instead, he like
try to not be in.
He set me up situation. To like maybe strike his car, but my horse trailer backing up skills.
Thank goodness.
I was gonna say, man. I know. I left so satisfied as I smiled at him, nice as pie, told him better luck next time.
Yeah. See you later.
So that was my thorn. And actually, I have a picture. I'll text it to you guys because I took a picture of the way I was
slightly your rose that you're that good at figuring out how to get out.
I was pretty proud of myself. I was like, I'm pretty good at this.
Screw him.
Yeah. But yeah, no one found the dogs the whole week when we were there. So all in all, it was fine.
All in all, you won.
But my rose is that I took my first lesson back on Mikey 2 weeks ago. So he is sound. He is not feral anymore. I've ridden the feral out of him. And yeah, it's like crazy to start thinking about like work and goals. And yeah, so I'm trying not to be greedy. I don't want to do too much too soon. I want him to be happy about going back to work. But for the first time in a really long time, guys, I feel very hopeful and happy and excited. So it's, you know, I'm trying not to live in fear of like, ooh, is he going to take a bad step? You know what I mean? Because that just haunts you and everything you do.
You have them.
I know. So I'm trying. My mantra now is don't be greedy. Don't live in fear. And just like enjoy what I've got. I think we made it out of the tunnel. So I'm very excited. He's doing really great. So I'm hoping I just have more good Mikey updates to share in the future. So
absolutely.
But what about you, Ellie?
Oh boy. So my thorn would be just that I have been really struggling to like actually find time to get on and actually ride the horses that I spend so much time taking care of and cleaning up after.
Right.
Just especially this spring. Like, I mean, my mom says, you complain about the mud every year. And I was like, yeah, I do. But like Matt even said, this is the worst year ever. So it's just been like, just frustrating because it's like I want to go out and just like be like, oh, and like snuggle with my horses, but they're all caked in mud. And I'm like, you know, and I have to put them out and I get covered in mud. And I didn't lose my I didn't fall in the mud. So that's a plus.
Lose your shoes, didn't fall in the mud.
That didn't happen. But it's just like really frustrating. So I'm hoping that like once this weather like calms down, because it's been, I've been so paranoid about everyone. I've been like feeding wet hay pellets because it's been like, you know, 15 degrees and then 60 degrees with like 12 hours in between.
Yeah.
So I've just been like so paranoid about them. And I was like, I don't want you to run around in the mud. Like, just calm down. Like, everyone just like breathe. And I'm probably just like telling myself to do that because I'm just like paranoid. But yeah, so I guess that would be my thorn, is I'm just like, I'm ready for to start doing stuff with my horses again and not just shoveling their crap. So that's my thorn, is that I'm ready for that to start happening. And I'm tired of shoveling poop. But my rose is horse related too, because like you, Justine, I said, screw it. I'm tired of living in fear. So I put Berkeley and Batman out in my biggest pasture, which is about 4 acres.
Wow.
And I mean, they weren't bad. They weren't naughty. I think they probably both ran maybe the equivalent of like 10, 15 strides before they were like, nah, grass.
Because they're so perfect.
And I'm just like,
they knew like we can't.
Yes. And it's been so like relieving to see them like actually be able to be happy horses again. Yeah. So I'm really excited about that. I just now have to figure out, because Batman and that mare that I got for free when he was in rehab, they don't get along, because Batman is the boss and the mare also thinks she's the boss. So I have to kind of slowly, I've been putting them in stalls next to each other, and I'm like, scream and get it out now, because eventually you'll need to go out to get there. So,
oh, no.
So, yeah, I've been working on that. But I'm just so happy to see them out in pastures and
happy.
Yeah, I'm just, yes, I'm a happy, happy, mud-depressed horse parent.
So we do have a mailbag that I think both of you have probably better answers than me for this. But how do you guys wash and store your blankets at the end of winter? Do you have like a system that works for you?
Do you want my truthful answer or my
I'll go first because I feel like mine is like not what everybody wants to hear, unfortunately. Okay, so sometimes we have to go to the washing machine, like to like a laundromat for like the big, big heavies.
Yeah.
But I'd say 95% of our blankets can go into our, we have a top loader with no agitator that's like almost an industrial one, like we bought for the barn. Like we literally saved up for this washing machine. Like it sounds crazy, but we're like, this is what we need because we're spending so much. So we bought
heavy duty.
It's heavy duty because literally we were spending so much money at like big washing machines. So like Doug and I years and years ago were like, okay, what's the one like right below commercial that we cannot spend, you know, 20 grand, but it was still expensive to us for us. So we bought the top loader, huge one with no agitator. And you can fit most heavies, like the super, super heavies. We have to like sometimes go to like an even bigger laundromat. But I, like I said, 95% of them we wash and then we hang dry and we wash all of them throughout the year if they're kind of gross. But then we wash them once or twice to really get them clean, spray them. We actually hang them on like the fencing to dry. And then per horse, we tie them up. We used to put them in bags, but now the blankets just keep getting bigger, I feel like. So now we tie them up per horse, and they're all labeled with the, and I think we've talked about this on the podcast before, the cow tags with a zip tie.
Yep, yeah.
So they're all labeled who owns, like what horse it is, you know, whatever, and then what size, and then also what weight it is, light, medium, heavy. And then we tie them all up in baling twine. And then we built an auxiliary barn, huge shelves for the blankets and all of our other stuff. But the blankets go out there.
I remember, I think Courtney shared that with us, like what that looked
she
like.
She was so excited when Alex, our guy that builds a bunch of our stuff, built. My mom thought there were bunk beds getting built. And I was like, we're building bunk beds in the ox barn for what, the kids to sleep in? And to be honest, I was really confused, but I was like, Mom, I'm not really sure what you're talking about. But anyways, we built what looks like bunk beds to my mother, a bunch of them so that we could just have so much more storage. So we had enough room to put extra trunks. So like all of this client's trunks and everything live out there in our extra trunks, whatever. But then all of our blankets and extra stuff lives out there in different spaces. So it's nice to have the different shelves that we can just throw them on. And then a lot of times we'll duct tape on the baling twine whose name it is. So then you just have to see, you know, Goody with the three blankets, you know, those are his three blankets.
Mm-hmm. Okay. That makes sense. What about you, Ellie? What's your routine?
Not nearly as organized.
I know. I was like, no one's going to love this answer because it really is actually quite organized.
No, it's like definitely a process that Matt would probably like me to do. But, you know, I'm lazy. So I've tried a couple different things. Like there's been a couple years where I power washed them before I took them to the laundromat, but, and I mean, before I moved to Pennsylvania, when I was in Connecticut, I've been kicked out of a couple laundromats, for bringing a lot of horse blankets. They're like, yeah, you can't bring those anymore. But the one by my house has not figured it out yet. I go at like 6:30 in the morning and I take up like 15 washers at a time. And I'm just like, boom, 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 and then I try to just like run out. And I dry them. I didn't used to, but I do now. And some of them have shrunk a little bit on the trim. And I'm like, it still fits good enough. Fine. So that's, yeah. I mean, that's what I do. I hide from the laundromat owner people and
right.
steal their washers so I can do it. I have been demoted. Matt's like, no, you're no longer allowed to wash them. In our washing machine where we wash our clothes.
Oh, yeah. I still do that at home, too. But I just do it on weeks that, like, Alex is traveling for work.
Yeah, well, we just got a new washing machine because ours kicked the bucket, probably because I've washed, like, so many girths in it and stuff. And it's just had so many things bang around in it. But that's
it. Yeah.
Yeah. But that's what I do. So I literally take them in enormous trash bags to the laundromat. I put them in clean trash bags, take them home. And then I personally just have like those big, like Rubbermaid latchable plastic things. And I try to put like all the sheets in one and like, you know, cause I'm like, well, these, you know, everyone will need. And then I throw like my less used ones, like the super heavy ones and stuff, you know, in different boxes. But basically, yeah, they're all in the basement. So, you know, it's Matt's jam session room. So he's got like all of his guitars, his drum set, you know, all the amps. And then there's just a lot of plastic bins with horse blankets. So that's what I do. That's what I found is the easiest. If I keep every time I've tried to keep them at a barn and not in one of those plastic things, I've had mice in them.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So I feel like keeping them covered. Yeah, I'm with you. So
keeping them covered is great, but we do it because we stick them up top and then we have our barn
cat. You have like a whole, yeah, I was going to say you have a whole nother building to put them in, which I think helps, you know?
Yeah.
Because that's what I do. I take mine home. I wash them in my home washer, much to my husband's horror, but I don't have like the middle fixture in the middle. So it's just like a front loader that I shove them in there. And then I let them like hang dry out on the fence in the backyard. And then once they're dry, I'm a blanket bag person that like hangs on my stall doors. So I just fold them up nice and neat, put them back in the blanket bags. And then I triple bag them in garbage bags and then throw them in my garage. And that's where they sit. So, you know, the next year. And then I tear open the garage, the garbage bags, and they're generally in pretty good shape. But it's not like I deal with extreme weather. Like they're in the heat over in summer, but they're all covered up, you know?
Yeah.
So I'm sure other people have creative ways that you wash and store your blankets. So if you guys want to share your routines with us in the Facebook group, we welcome it. I'd be curious to see what you all do. And if you have a question you want us to answer on the air, you can always send us an email at hello@heelsdownmedia.com or join that Facebook group that I just mentioned. It's the Heels Down Happy Hour Podcast Lounge. Search for it. Join it. We have fun conversations there. Ellie recently shared her picture of her and Matt dressed as Mario and Luigi that you really don't want to miss. So join
cute.
The Facebook group. And if you want to hear more from us, check out heelsdownmag.com. We're going to be channeling all the news and interesting things that you've read in the Spark back to our website. And also follow us on social media. Right now, we're at Heelsdown Happy Hour on Instagram. And on Facebook, we're Heelsdown Mag. And if you love this show, if you love the Heelsdown Happy Hour podcast, please rate and review us on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Google Play, wherever you listen to podcasts. We want to say thank you to Live Eck and Zero Proof this week. And that's a wrap, guys. Cheers.
Cheers.